we as humans want to be in relationship with each other. We want people to understand us. And this is part of the book, we're a myth-making species.
Hello and welcome to The Right Question, a radio program and podcast featuring authors from the American West and beyond. The Right Question is supported in part by Humanities Montana and members of Montana Public Radio, and by the Greater Montana Foundation, encouraging communication on issues, trends, and values of importance to Montanans. I'm Lauren Korn, speaking with Betsy Gaines Quammen, author of True West, Myth and Mending on the Far Side of America, a book that explores the myths of the West and how, if left unexamined, they distort the realities of the present and exacerbate polarizations. Betsy interrogates these myths by carefully listening to people from varying political and cultural perspectives. Betsy Gaines Quammen is a historian and writer. She received a PhD from Montana State University, where she studied religion, history, and the philosophy of science. Her work has appeared in the New York Times, New York Daily News, and the History News Network. She is the author of American Zion, Clive and Bundy, God and Public Lands in the West, and the book we're talking about here, True West. Betsy lives in Montana with her husband, writer David Quammen, their three giant dogs, a sturdy cat, and a lanky rescue python. Betsy, thanks so much for joining me today. Welcome to The Right Question.
Lauren, thank you so much for having me. I'm really looking forward to our conversation.
I am too. To start, I want to ask you about your landscape of origin or your primal landscape. Where do you feel most at home? Is that where you were born? Is it different from the landscape that you've chosen?
That's interesting. I really feel like the West is a place that I most identify with. And having worked in such a vast scope in the West. I've been living in Montana for 31 years. I lived in Colorado for 5 years where I was a reporter and got to cover some of the Southern Rockies issues. I did my dissertation in Utah and Southern Nevada. I did my thesis, master's thesis in the Thunder Basin National Grasslands in Wyoming. And I think because of my opportunity to be in such amazing places focused on work and really trying to understand both the ecology and the culture of these places, the West to me seems like home.
Were you born out here?
No. I grew up in Cincinnati, and I grew up going to Colorado and really learned to ski there and sort of had an idea of the West as a place to recreate, a place of wild places. And that was my own myth, the myth that lured me.
Sure.
And so when I was 18, actually for a semester, I went to high school in Colorado. And then when I was 18, I went to college in Colorado and then lived there for a while working as a reporter, and then worked my way up to Montana to graduate school and have been here ever since.
Haven't looked back.
Have not looked back.
You know, in trying to figure out a way to structure this particular interview, I thought it might be fitting to first talk about something you wrote in your previous book, American Zion, and then something that you feature prominently on your website. I'm gonna quote you, Betsy. You write, "Americans need to know Western history to understand our relationship with land, but we can't use its history as a template for its future." Tell me what you mean by that, and tell me how this idea informed your writing and your research of the book that we're here to talk about today, which is True West.
Yeah, that's a quote I've thought quite a bit about. And when I wrote it, I really was thinking about Western extraction. I was thinking about ways of viewing land and resources as things to monetize. I was looking at ways of seeing land not as a value in and of itself, but as a commodity. And I've kind of revised that thinking a little bit after looking particularly at Nick Estes' book, which is amazing. Mm-hmm. And I believe the title is Our History is the Future. And he talks about cultural beliefs, indigenous cultural beliefs, that actually are a template for ways that we can look at the West and ways that we can value the West. And so I really have thought about that quote differently, and he's been a big influence.
You know, this isn't a drafted question, but I found myself while reading True West oscillating so much between what I know to be my truth of the West and my beliefs of the West. And how do I want to say this? I just feel like this book, more than many that I've experienced, really holds space for multiple perspectives. And what the book did for me was it made me question so many different ideas of land and of this area. You have so many different perspectives. Does that scan for you, that this idea that there's this kind of polyvocal tension in the book that
Yes, absolutely. I agree with what you're saying. And it is a little bit hard to articulate, because one of the things that I thought about in going about writing this book is that the truth of the West is a constellation, and that we all bring our perspectives in terms of how we see this place to conversation and to imagining it. And so it's really important, particularly now at this moment when we are ever more polarized and more people are pouring into our communities, to be able to understand that we see things differently. And that is particularly important, and you hit on it, when we do have extremists coming into our communities. So that was one piece of this book. I really tried to look at various pressures and toxic myths that communities face in the Western landscape. And extremists are coming to our communities. They are pressuring places that have had difficult economic situations that may have been part of boom and bust, mining, logging, and in some cases, ranching communities. And so it was really important to me, in order to keep our communities healthy, to understand where different people are coming from and be able to be in conversation with people who are vulnerable to extremist views, because we're seeing it. And again, that's one piece of this book, but it is a piece that I'm familiar with, because in a way, this book was a companion piece to American Zion, American Zion being my first book about the Bundy family, who were religious extremists in southern Nevada that were in a feud with the government over trespassing cattle.
I think while you were talking, one of the things that occurred to me was the space that you give for your readers, for yourself, for the people that you've interviewed in this book to change their minds. You allow space for, again, many perspectives, but the idea that minds change.
Having the ability to think things through and to be nimble in thinking is really imperative in keeping conversation going and keeping communities healthy. And one of the men I interviewed who comes to mind is somebody who left this extremist culture, this Christian nationalist community that was part of folks in North Idaho, the Idaho Panhandle, all the way over to Eastern Washington, and that he really was able to consider his role in very dangerous ideology, and he became a whistleblower. So I was interested in having conversations with people who had epiphanies. And I, you know, another person who I thought was really interesting was a woman that I talked to in Escalante, Utah, who had grown up in LDS culture and had left the church. But she's very interesting in the sense that, because there are a lot of people who've left the Mormon church who are really angry for good reason, you know, that have issues that they are mad at the church about. I also know a lot of Mormon people who are wonderful and have a very good relationship with the church. I should say that. But she now is in Escalante, and she feels very protective of her Mormon heritage, and she gets very angry at conservationists, environmentalists who come in and say, I know what's best for your community and your ecosystem. You all don't know how to take care of your public land. And it's interesting because she works for the Forest Service. People are complicated. People are not fixed. And one of the ways that I use to describe this is I talk about the West as a museum of toxic myths.
Yes.
And yet, as humans, we're not just displays. We're not fixed. We really do have the ability to think and consider and review and relate. And so this book really is a navigation around that idea.
You said at the very top of that answer, you were talking about the truth, and you put it in scare quotes, the quote-unquote truth. And I want to talk about your book's title, True West. That is such a sticky word, true. It's really a word that the book sets out to unpack, really, which of the many, many myths in this museum about this region are true or is true. So tell me, Betsy, how you thought about truth when you first started writing this book about this region, maybe before this book, and how you think about truth now, having published this book.
The title True West came from the Sam Shepard play. I mean, I love that play, and I love also the idea of a true West, because that doesn't exist. I mean, or it exists in many different ways. There's so many different ways of seeing truth. That said, this title also came because of a frustration that I had coming out of pandemic, where truth was so badly misrepresented, and that there was so much disinformation, misinformation, and low information. And I really wanted to understand how people saw the chapter we were going through in terms of pandemic and polarization, but also how they saw our country and our region. And as a result, I really did talk to people about a variety of different subjects. This book is about so much.
So much.
And I intentionally did that because I felt like the things that this book talks about are woven together. We needed to understand climate, and we needed to understand Black Lives Matter, and we needed to understand pandemic and polarization and ecosystem health and water scarcity and all the things that are interlinked and that we deal with in our community and how we saw those things. So the book really was my own interest in looking at where we are and how we're seeing these very real issues and how these issues and our ways of seeing are impacted by Western mythology.
You're listening to A Conversation with Betsy Gaines Quammen. I'm Lauren Korn. This episode of The Right Question is supported by Fact and Fiction, an independent bookstore located in the heart of downtown Missoula, Montana, providing books for all ages and supporting the literary community in Montana and beyond. More information can be found at factandfictionbooks.com. You mentioned that you wanted to bring COVID, this idea that we were in the midst of a pandemic, into this narrative as well. I'm curious about the timeline of the book. Did you have this idea before COVID, or was it was COVID that maybe brought this idea to the fore in your mind? What was the timeline?
Yeah, I started writing it. Okay, so American Zion,
the previous book,
came out in March of 2020. And so I didn't have a book tour, or I didn't have much to do.
Yeah.
So I thought, okay, what do I do now? We're in the midst of something big. Can I look at some of the ideas I brought up in American Zion, which really does talk about a family that's very much impacted by Western mythology, this cowboy myth, this rugged individualism, this idea of hyper-liberty, and Mormon worldview. I mean, there's early church theology that really informs the Bundy standoff in Nevada, which is where I went and talked to the family right after the standoff in Nevada. And then a year after I was there, the sons of Clive and Bundy, the rancher in Nevada, took over the Malheur Wildlife Refuge.
Right.
And so my first book really did look at all the various ways that Western theology and early Mormon church theology informed their actions. And so I was very interested in how religious ideologies and mythologies inform us, even if we're not necessarily aware of it. So I thought, okay, I'm going to look at what's happening to the West during pandemic, because we were getting all the COVID refugees. Somehow people were convinced if they came west and they were in the mountains that somehow they would be healthier. Where does that myth come from? Well, it comes from the idea that the West is hale and hearty, or it's salubrious. Meanwhile, we have some of the highest suicide rates in the country in Western states. And so these ideas that were luring people here, the idea of free land that goes back to ideas of manifest destiny, well, it's not free, but it was really inexpensive to some people. Those of us who lived here were having trouble buying property and living here, and people were leaving. And so I think that there were these things that were happening during COVID that I saw so clearly being motivated by Western mythology that I wanted to write about it. And so I went about writing about all the things and biblical literalism. I start the book visiting the Creation Museum in Glendive, Montana, to talk about, you know, what happens when people are so entrenched in thought and ideology that they're unwilling to even believe that the world is older than 6,000 years. And so, you know, that I saw that really playing out as people decided what they thought about politics or pandemic without giving consideration to more evidence and to an ongoing discovery of what was happening with that disease, or ongoing analysis of what was happening politically. And so, because I started there with this kind of, you know, lockstep thinking of biblical literalism, and I saw that that really permeated a lot of what we were thinking about in terms of the West. And, you know, I go into manifest destiny. I go into the idea of the myth of discovery, that, you know, this is not discovered land. This is indigenous land. And so all these things really came into play in analyzing what was happening to the West at this particular moment. And this idea did come out of pandemic, and I wanted to write about it.
So then, Betsy, was American Zion the point at which you first decided to use your knowledge of or your research of religion as a lens to look at landscape and conservation?
You have asked me one of my favorite questions, and I will tell you, I was part of a coalition building organization. We worked with religious leaders in Mongolia, Buddhist monks in particular, on fisheries and river conservation, with Buddhist monks on snow leopard conservation, and with Jewish communities, Christian communities, Muslim communities, and Buddhist communities in the United States on pollinator protection. And so I think that there's real wisdom, and I mentioned Nick Estes and his fabulous book, that we really do need to think about different ways of seeing landscape through traditional knowledge, through cultures that aren't motivated by Judeo-Christian ideas of subdual and dominion. And so I became very, very interested in how various cultures see landscape. And as I said, I worked with this organization for 8 years. And then I went to do my dissertation looking at how a religion, and in this case, Latter-day Saint, looked at landscape in very different ways. And there was an understanding in Mormon worldview that a built landscape pleases the eye of God. So I focused with my dissertation and with American Zion on how religious views can be destructive in terms of protecting the environment. I should say it's a lot more complicated than that, and there's been some wonderful work by scholars who have looked at Mormon environmental sort of perspectives, and Brigham Young had some very interesting things to say about protecting the environment. So I don't want to just call out the Latter-day Saints, but Christianity, Judeo-Christian ways of seeing have and Mormonism, which came from those same points of view, do have some troubling ways of looking at how humans are different from landscapes, that we were created in the image of God rather than being part of landscape. And so I became very, very interested in looking at religion and landscape.
I'm curious where the impulse for you to focus on religion came from. Did you grow up religious? Where did, you know, your dissertation leaned so heavily into it? What was that spark? Where did that happen?
I did not grow up religious. I in fact, at one point was singing a hymn with my dad, and we were in church and we were trying to out-sing each other, and my mom told me I was never allowed to go to church again. So I didn't go to church. I became interested in religion for a very weird reason. I worked for years and years in conservation in Montana, and I was focused on grizzly bear protection, and I was focused on connectivity and habitats, and I was focused on bull trout and protecting, you know, cold water fisheries, that kind of thing. Mm-hmm. And I realized that we continually spoke to people who already were invested in what we were trying to say. We were never talking to constituencies that didn't agree with us. And I also found that there was an enormous aversion to talk with religious groups, that there was just a condescension that went into how we approached different demographics and who we talked to. And it wasn't getting our issue out there in a way that I felt like it was effective. So I really became very interested in what motivates people, and I understood that religion really motivates people. And so I started looking at how we could engage religious leaders in our work, and it was really easy, and I really felt like there was an enormous amount of enthusiasm. And if I told somebody that a particular fish was important, that would be in no way, in any way, more motivating than if a religious leader told them that a fish is important. Like, I mean, empowering religious leaders really did have an impact in the work that we did, and it felt good to be able to empower this community. And I learned so much. I mean, I really learned a lot about, again, biblical literalism and how dangerous that is, and also about different ways of seeing the idea of sentient beings, the idea, even in Christianity, the idea that God created the birds of the sky and the fish of the sea, and it was good, that there are things that we can look at that really are important to address when talking to different demographics and communities.
The subtitle of your book is Myth and Mending on the Far Side of America. Is healing, or as this subtitle suggests, amending, possible in the American West?
It's so hard to think about it when we are daily deluged with such grim news. And I can see that. I have days where I think, oh my God. But I think that I have a lot of faith after writing this book in communities. Mm. And I think people love our communities. And I do take on the influx of people who came to the West with with misunderstandings that have affected communities in terms of equity, and people have their own little versions of the West. They have second homes here. Some of the things that really do make communities put pressure on communities. But I think that if folks come to the West with a willingness to invest in communities and a willingness to get involved, and that those of us who live here who care so deeply are willing to keep our institutions healthy and thriving, that are willing to be involved in politics, that are willing to vote, that are willing to think about how to keep our natural resources healthy. How can we think about developments that do allow for people to afford housing but also maintain elk habitat? What are we doing in terms of community planning and relationship building that allows for vibrancy and opportunity and peace? And I know that's a really weird word to say, but one of the things that I talked to a rancher about is this idea of civil war, because there are people in this country that are taking over communities. I mean, again, the Idaho Panhandle, they want to create like-minded communities. They want to have people uncomfortable. They want to be involved in confrontational politics. I talk about it in this book, to prevent people from even wanting to be involved in these communities that they love so much. How can we keep that at bay? And I really think it's through relationship building, and it's through involvement, and it's through calling the bad guys out. Mm. When I started this book out, I was really angry. I just was furious because I saw what Trump was doing. I saw the enormous amounts of misinformation coming out about COVID. I saw disease being political. It really made me furious. And so I thought, you know what? I cannot keep getting versions of what other people think from social media. I really need to go out and have conversation. And I realized that it was so liberating to pull myself back from the onslaught of what was happening on social media and actually be in conversation with people. And I think that in talking about this book and being in conversation with people, I'm over and over and over again reminded that we as humans want to be in relationship with each other. We want people to understand us. And this is part of the book, we're a myth-making species. So we are going to live among myths, and I really think it's important for us to understand those myths in order to not allow them to become toxic. So that's been another thing in talking to people. It's been reaffirmed.
That was Betsy Gaines Quammen, author of True West, Myth and Mending on the Far Side of America. Out now from Torrey House Press. Look for more information about Betsy at mtpr.org, where you can also subscribe to our podcast and follow us on Facebook and Instagram. You've been listening to The Right Question. This episode was produced by Chris Moyles and me. I'm your host, Lauren Korn. Sierra Thomas at KGLT in Bozeman, Montana, engineered this episode. A thank you to both Sierra and to KGLT for letting us use their studio. The artwork for The Right Question was designed by Molly Russell, and our music was written and recorded by John Floridis. Funding for The Right Question is provided by the Greater Montana Foundation, encouraging communication on issues, trends, and values of importance to Montanans. Many thanks to Humanities Montana for supporting this program since 2008. And thank you for listening. The Right Question is a production of Montana Public Radio.